I came across an article entitled Rules That Guys Wished Women Knew. And I'm sure it could have been very extensive, that list, and run on and on, but it curtailed itself to 10 things that men wished that women knew. I'm not going to give you all 10, just a few examples that you might or might not consider relevant. Number one was, ask what you want. Subtle hints don't work. Anything we say 6 or 8 months ago is inadmissible in an argument. You have too many shoes. You have enough clothes. If something we said can be interpreted two ways, and one of the ways makes you sad and angry, then we meant the other one. Sometimes we're not thinking about you. Live with it. Christopher Columbus didn't need directions, and neither do we. And of course, I must add to that final one, that's the very thing that said, when you're driving round and round in circles and the guy behind the wheel is so bullish in his mood that I knew how to get there, and only when you recognise that he has actually been round this way 3 times now, can you begin to persuade him, no he doesn't. I'm not going to venture a guess or two as to which of the rules that I've read out is true. All I will say is that some of them certainly sound believable, if not entirely familiar. Rules that guys wished women knew. I'm sure we could reverse that and go vice versa, and it would be exactly the same. There'd be a lot of rules that girls would wish guys would know and would take good account of in the way they live. The day we live, though, is a day that is filled with knowledge. Every conceivable subject under the sun has page after page, if not volume after volume, of knowledge that has been written about it. There's not a subject that you can conceive about, but you can't flick a switch on the internet, go through a bit of a browser there, and come to thousands, if not even millions, potentially, of hits dealing with that particular subject. The knowledge we have, it means that we're going further, means that we're flying higher, means that we're travelling faster than at any other given time in all of man's history upon this globe. And we are fast approaching a time when there's going to be an absolute knowledge overload. I, with some interest, listened in to veteran Labour politician Tony Benn, recently giving an interview on Radio 5. I happened to be travelling down to Belfast, turned it on, there he was, recognised the voice even though the age could be seen coming through very clearly there, but he said something that was very interesting in the context in which we're speaking today. He said, you know, it's a very humbling thing that whenever you get up every single morning, the longer you live, the less you know. More knowledge has been discovered from the time that you put your head on the pillow on one night to you lifted off that pillow the next morning. And he said it's an incredible thing and very humbling as well. There's no doubt about that. In fact, the Bible prophesied this. It's never running slow in this kind of thing or in any area of our living. Back in the book of Daniel, the chapter 12, the verse 4, the Lord is telling Daniel what's going to happen in future time. And he says, if you catapult yourself right through to the time of the end, that's the period he was talking about, the time of the end, knowledge shall be increased. There will be a build-up, an increase, a whole array of knowledge that is developing and released. Today we live at a time where 80% of all the scientists who have ever lived are alive. Over 15,000 scientific journals are being published. Many of those have worldwide circulation. Since World War II, we're told there's an estimated 70% of all of our medicines that have been developed since that time. Knowledge is clearly increasing. Now, one of the most common sayings and the mottos even of our day is this: it's not what you know, but it's who you know that matters. And we can scan over the secular realm, and we can see many, many times over just how true that particular adage is. Prestige, well, it helps who you know. Power really helps who you know. Popularity, prominence, politics are often a result of who someone knew rather than what they knew. Now, while that statement is true in the secular realm, it's undoubtedly true in the spiritual realm. The Christian life is based not so much upon what you know as who you know. I know you'll agree with me today when I say there is nothing more important in the life of an individual child of the Lord than the knowledge of the one who saved them. Yes, we can accumulate facts. Yes, we can comb the book, the Bible, for figures. Yes, we can excel in quizzes on general knowledge about Bible topics and all the rest of it. And we can be a virtual Bible encyclopedia in terms of our knowledge of place names and dates and personages and all the rest of it. But there is nothing more important than the knowledge of God Himself. As Paul put it so memorably, over in Philippians 3, the verse 10. This is the crusade of my life, he was saying. This is why I am alive. This is my focus in living, that I may know him. Sinclair Ferguson said, the knowledge of God is the heart of salvation and all true spiritual experience. Knowing him is what we were created for. It will occupy us throughout all eternity. Now that's the very subject that Jeremiah the prophet was contemplating in Jeremiah chapter 9. He was looking around, and right through the nation were the ripples of ignorance and a film of indifference covering the minds and the hearts of the people. And they had no desire after the knowledge of God. They did not want to know him at all. And God's verdict on the issue appears in verse 23 and 24, among other parts of the passage, but prominently here, verse 23 and 24, thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might, let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. Addressing as the Lord was a burdened prophet who was working among a spiritually blind people. God tells him, in spite of all the pomp and all the circumstance you see around you, in spite of the flouting of wisdom, in spite of man rearing up on his hind legs and feeling he has arrived, through Jeremiah, God is saying it's not what you know, but who you know that counts for time and that counts for eternity. Today we're going to underline three truths about knowing God. One is the priority of knowing God. The priority of knowing God. Children beginning our Sunday school program will find, yes, they'll be assigned Bible verses to memorize, but the first question they will come across when they're moving through to the shorter catechism is this: what is man's chief end? Man's chief end, the answer comes, is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Well, if I am to glorify God, and that's what Jeremiah 9, 23 and 24 is saying here, we're not to be glorying in wisdom, not to be glorying in might, not to be glorying in riches. If we are to glory, and we should be glorying in this, that we understand and we know God. Glorify God. That's what we're meant to do. Well, how can we glorify God unless we know him? And it stands to sense, the more we know about him, the greater we are going to be able to glorify him. And so we must funnel our lives embark upon this unending pursuit. Let me know more about God. In Jeremiah 9, 23, 24, you'll notice here that in the land there was a refusal of divine knowledge, a refusal of divine knowledge. God is trying to correct this when he says, "Thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me." Clearly, the nation was out of sync. They were not going down the right path. God wants to redirect them. God wants them to refocus their energies in living. He wants them to embark upon a quest that to this time they had refused to embark upon. By and large, the people were not chasing after God. They did not want to get to know him intimately. They much preferred wisdom, because if we can get wisdom, we'll appeal to people around us. They'll applaud us. They'll look upon us as being the proper philosophers in this age, the people that can give out all the information that man can possibly ingest. They'll glory not only in wisdom, but in their power, the strength of man, masculinity of his freedom, not only physical power, but influence. How can we dominate people? How can we bring a whole army of people under our control? He was glorying in that. And also glorying in riches. I've got something better than you have. We are really prosperous in society. These were the things that attracted the minds of the people back then. This is what really concerns them. Look back to Jeremiah 9, verse 6. Thine habitation is in the midst of deceit. Through deceit they refuse to know me, saith the Lord. And right through this opening part of the chapter, in Jeremiah chapter 9, we reach one conclusion. Here was a people digging in their heels, and they were refusing to know God. F.B. Meyer explains that the first part of chapter 9 of Jeremiah, we visit here the folly of a faithless people. There was a refusal of divine knowledge. It wasn't because the people lacked opportunity. The Lord, you see, had given them every opportunity, plenty of opportunities to know him. He had practically bent himself over backwards to make it possible for them to have a good knowledge of himself. But they said, "No, we don't want that. That's not the thing that excites our mind. That's not the thing that captivates our heart." And so by deception and by denial, they brought about their own ignorance and their own destruction. And how true that is of the land in which we live today. We often talk about the revivals of real spiritual religion that have happened here. And inevitably, we'll go back to the 1859 revival 150 years ago. We'll talk about the revival in Wales 1904. We'll talk about that which affected the Outer Hebridean island, particularly of Lewis, in the late 1940s. We will talk about an Ulster awakening back around the 1920s under the preaching of Nicholson. And we will say what a goodly gospel heritage we have throughout the United Kingdom. And there's no question that we really do have tremendous privileges in this. But in the middle of these privileges, and the middle of all of our opportunities, we have tragically failed. God has made himself known. Bibles are sprinkled throughout the homes across our province. God's power has been shown in revivals that we have mentioned, and yet there is a refusal of divine knowledge. Not interested. How many in the population basically have that stamped across their forehead, certainly written and engraved in their hearts? We don't want to know. Knowledge of God, there's a refusal of this divine knowledge, just as there was in the days of Jeremiah. Notice as well, there was a reliance on human knowledge. You push out one kind of knowledge, you bring in something else. Man becomes God. Man is the one who was glorified deified even Jeremiah 9:23. Thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might, let not the rich man glory in his riches. These were their building blocks of life. Might, wisdom, riches, the foundation on which our lives must be constructed. And so they refuse divine knowledge, but they pull in human knowledge. A classic picture, snapshot of the state of affairs today. People not only refuse to know the one who by his word spoke everything into existence, but they commit the further tragedy of relying on their own wisdom, their own might, their own riches, human knowledge. Now, we said a little at the beginning of the message in the introduction about how knowledge was on the increase. Studies have shown that the halfway point of all human knowledge is located less than 10 years ago. What we're saying by that is man's knowledge has doubled over the course of the past 10 years. Every 60 seconds, and I'm sure these are old stats now, 2,000 typewritten pages are added to the knowledge of man, material that is produced. Every 24 hours will take one person 5 years to read. Now that's an impossible task. You can see where Tony Benn was coming from when he said what he did. Material produced every 24 hours takes a person 5 years to read. There are many discoveries concerning memory chips, and we know all about that with our computers and our digital cameras and everything else. Many of them can operate so quickly that they can assimilate into permanent storage 5 million words per second. How does the Bible sit with that in terms of a volume? In the Bible we have 850,000 words. That kind of memory that we've just talked about would be capable of assimilating the entire Bible 6 times in 1 second and bring it again word by word, any passage, any verse, any place, at a command in a 200th billion of a second. And I was reading recently about Toshiba with their NAND flash technology fitting into our cameras. And they're talking about the world's fastest data transfer rate, write speed, 35 megabytes per second, read speed, 60 megabytes per second. If you're not into computer jargon, this is going to be over your head. Don't worry, just let it stay there. It's probably the safest place to be. What we're saying is, knowledge is increasing, and at what speed? It's incredible. But while we know much about material, natural things around us, man today is suffering under a dreadful ignorance of spiritual things. He can boast about what he knows about this world and all of its working around him. He knows very, very little about another world in which God rules and God reigns, and from which Jesus will return unto this world that he has made. Sinclair Ferguson said it best, I believe, the only God we can know in our way is a God that we make in our image. That's how it was in the days of Jeremiah. The people refused the knowledge of God, and they built upon human knowledge. On that they relied. The priority of knowing God, the purpose in knowing God, why should we know God? Why does this world need to know God? In verse 24 of Jeremiah 9, God says, but let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord, which exercised loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight, saith the Lord. Why should we know God? Well, the purpose here is to produce recognition of his being. Recognition of his being. But let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that he recognizes who God is. That's why we need the knowledge of God, to know him personally. And when people know him personally, they're growing, they're developing in a relationship with him, and it will leave a mark upon their lives. It will affect how they live. This prophet Jeremiah was no ivory tower theologian. He wasn't just an author, though he did write. But he was a man suffering for the sake of his people, seeing things with the clarity of a one who was an outsider in society, a reject from the people, but he was taken into the center of the society of God. He knew God. And he interpreted everything that he saw around him by means of his knowledge of God. It means he cut through all the superficialities of life, all the trivial things he just swept aside, and he got right to the heart of the matter, and the heart of the matter was to know God. Who cares for the wisdom of this world, or for the strength of man, or for the riches and the fame that some people attain, if these things do not include the knowledge of God? It seems to me the question of God to the prophet here was this: what is the point in living if at the center of that life there is no knowledge of me? Knowing him would produce a recognition of his being. Knowing God would provoke a realization of his behavior. Not only his being, who he is, but his behavior, how he acted. Knowing God shows us how he acted and tells us by extension how we should act in the world today. You ever get the impression, driving around even in the car, nobody cares for anybody apart from themselves? You know, if that means, although I'm not going off this dual carriageway for 2 solid miles, if I want to drive in the fast lane and stay there at 45 miles per hour, it's my right to do that. Ever been annoyed by that? I'm sure you have. If you've been driving recently at all, you've been well bugged by people doing that. It's increasing. And people come in and they're looking a service from some business or whatever, and they just expect it all to be done on the spot for them. No room for any problems to occur, any difficulties to emerge, no patience if anything does. People just living for themselves, not caring about how they live, affecting other people around them. Jeremiah 9:24, God is saying, if we know God, that will provoke a realization of God's behavior, how he acts, and let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord, which, here's what he does, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. God is saying here, I'm a balanced God. I am a God who exercises loving kindness right through to the other end of the spectrum, righteousness. I show pardon for sin, but I also punish sin. Loving kindness I exercise, judgment I exercise, righteousness I exercise in the earth. Contemplate me, study my activity, see how I work, and replicate that in the way that you live. I think of a nursery school teacher who told everybody to draw a picture of what was important to them. And down at the back of the room, Johnny began his drawing, and he was intensely engaged. Everybody else was finished in that class, handed in their picture. Johnny stubbornly refused. He was still drawing. Now, the teacher was patient. She walked to the back of the class, put her arm around Johnny's shoulder, said, Johnny, what are you drawing? He didn't look up. Just kept on drawing his picture. What are you drawing, Johnny? Eventually he looked at her and he said, I'm drawing God. The teacher gently said, but Johnny, nobody knows what God looks like. He smiled and he said, they will when I'm finished. Not one of us has a clue about what God looks like. But we've been given this whole body of revealed truth from Genesis right through to Revelation to uncover who he is, to tell us where he is at, to instruct us in what he does. And this book is filled with the divine activity of God. He's the author, he's the agent, he is also the actor in his own book. And all that we know about God has been revealed to us by God. And he alone is a good and a fair, reliable witness unto himself. We have Jesus talking to those 2 disconsolate disciples as they're trudging home to Emmaus after the crucifixion. And they feel that all they'd ever trusted in for the past 3 years has now evaporated. But we find in the book of Luke, chapter 24, verse 27, that Jesus opens the scriptures and opens their mind to the scriptures. And we're told beginning at Moses and all the prophets, starting off in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, he moved right through to Jeremiah, right through to Malachi, and he expounded unto them and all the scriptures the things concerning himself. He's saying, look, Genesis, there's me. You didn't miss that signpost, did you? Look, in the Psalms, there's me. Look as well, Isaiah speaks of me. Malachi talks about me, the Son of Righteousness, who shall return. The book is all about God, all about Christ. And when we come into a living relationship with him, we study the word, we're enlightened as to his being, also as to his behavior. We know who he is, we also know what he does. And as we begin to know him more, we say with Richard of Chichester, day by day, dear Lord, of thee, three things I pray: to see thee more clearly, to love thee more dearly, to follow thee more nearly. This God that Jeremiah says is a God who exercises loving kindness, judgment, righteousness in the earth, that sets down a template for us and says, walk in my footsteps, be like Jesus. This my song. That's what God is saying here. The priority of knowing God, the purpose in knowing God, quickly, the pleasure from knowing God. The pleasure from knowing God. The world feels it has a monopoly in pleasure. If you're looking for satisfaction, visit its places of satisfaction and pleasure. It says all you'll ever want, you'll find with us. And everybody finds it's not true. Ultimately, and often damningly, they find it's not true. Jeremiah 9:24, but let him that glorieth, glory in this. Here's something you can take pleasure in. Glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. Pleasure. God is saying, I take pleasure in these things. It's in these things I delight. And that's what you're to glory in as well. That's what you are to find your pleasure in. The wise man, the mighty man, the rich man, glorying in their wisdom, in their might, in their riches, are missing the point, are way off track, are headed for destruction. What you need to understand is God, like that Ethiopian eunuch in his chariot. Philip the evangelist comes along to him in the desert, Acts chapter 8. Understandest thou what thou readest? And he brought to his attention that day, to his mind, to his pleasure and pardon, Christ. For he preached unto him from the words of Isaiah 53, Jesus. And what pleasure that brought to that man's heart and life. And then as we grow deeper, we get into Ephesians chapter 1, for example, and we read down, coming to know Christ, what does that result in? And all the blessings are tumbling out there, one after the other, in Ephesians chapter 1, and you unfold it, and you're looking at a complete catalogue of blessings that there are in Jesus for the child of God, and we read them, and we say, pleasure! Pure, unalloyed, spiritual pleasure in Christ. The ultimate goal is reached in attaining the knowledge of God. The story is told of a lady whose husband recently died. He didn't leave any written will. Needless to say, the lady was devastated at the loss of her partner, who had been with her for more than 50 years. Over that time, they'd laughed together, cried together, shared everything together. And yet, when the news came through that her husband had died, she was completely unprepared, every bit as much as he was. Seeing that he had left no written will, she proceeded to go ahead. She made decisions. 1, 2, 3, just right down the line. Immediately she made them. No hesitation whatsoever. And a friend was amazed to see her in action at the time, and she asked her, "How can you know to do all this?" And that wife, whose husband died, said, "I lived with him for 50 years. I knew him so well that I don't need a will. I know exactly what he would have wanted done." We should know God like that woman knew her husband. Do we know him today? How well do we know him? How well do we know about his person, his behavior, from loving kindness in its perfection right through to righteousness in its perfection, the whole rainbow spectrum of perfections and attributes of God, his divinity, his dealings with man? How well do we know him? It is our priority in life to know God. Have you a heart that's weary, tending a load of care? Are you a soul that's seeking rest from the burden you bear? Do you know my Jesus? Do you know, my friend, have you heard that he loves you and he will abide till the end? This is our chief business, knowing God, the priority, the purpose, and the pleasure from knowing him.